Obama on the Men in the Desert. And what I would like to do is actually go back again to where we were before that, because number one, there are a few more words I want to say about the Men in the Desert. And number two, in order to understand what happened after that, it really will help us to read what happens before that. So if you'll go to 61b4, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but I just will review with you. It's been a little while, so we should catch up and know, remind ourselves of what the subject is. Remember that we had been reading about whether, if a person transgresses the prohibition against taking interest and has taken interest, whether the interest taken is recoverable. By recoverable, that most likely means that it's recoverable by bringing an action in court, that it's that there is grounds and you can bring an action in court in order to recover the interest. That, of course, is not the only way that you might recover the interest. There's really another way. The other way is to not see this necessarily as a legal matter, where we conceive of a legal matter, and therefore you can bring a person to court in order to achieve the goal that you want to achieve, but rather a moral matter. It could be that a person should return the money once it is clear to all the parties concerned that he has taken interest, and that there should be some moral motivation to do that. So just because we say that it's not necessarily actionable in court doesn't foreclose other possibilities. So you have to keep that in mind as we see this discussion. Amar Rabbi Elazar, ribit ketsutza yotza b'dayanim. Ribit ketsutza means fixed interest. Right? Now, we had already seen that there are two kinds of interest. One is ribit ketsutza. You take a loan from somebody. You borrow 100 shekels. And he says, that's fine as long as you're paying back 105. That's ribit ketsutza. That's a fixed interest rate. Okay? So, he says, ribit ketsutza yotza b'dayanim. If a man has unjustly earned interest on a loan that he has given, then that is actionable in court. Right? Yotza b'dayanim. He can have the money returned by taking the man to court. However, remember this is Rabbi Elazar, however, avak ribit ena yotza b'dayanim. Avak ribit, literally the dust of interest, cannot be returned through a court. Now, remember what avak ribit means. Avak ribit, we learned, means any interest that is considered rabbinic interest. When we were dealing with a forward contract, for example, the Torah does not prohibit forward contracts. That is a construction of the rabbi because it is like interest. It isn't interest. It's like interest. The Talmud has defined those terms as avak ribit. Avak ribit means rabbinic interest as opposed to Torah interest. Torah interest is the fixed interest for a particular loan. Okay? So, Rabbi Elazar says that avak ribit eina yotza v'dayanim. That amount of money that was taken as interest as far as a rabbinic type of interest, that you cannot get back from the judges. Okay? Then that's not the end of it. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Rabbi Yochanan says, Afilu ribit ketsutza nami eino yotza b'dayanim. Rabbi Yochanan takes the point of view that even a fixed interest rate, even something that we consider to be interest from the Torah, is not actionable in court. You shouldn't do it. You're not allowed to do it. But we cannot say that you can bring a court action as a result of that. Okay? Now, the Gemara will want to find out what's the reasoning. So, first, it seeks some reasoning for Rabbi Yochanan's position. Because, frankly, the way I read it, Rabbi Elazar has the better position. I mean, wouldn't it make sense that if you take money unjustly, that whoever is injured by that should have a case that he can get his money back? I mean, that's what makes sense just intuitively. That's the point of view that I think makes more sense, at least as far as the Torah law is concerned. All right, I can understand that the non-Torah law, the rabbinic law, could be different. But it seems to be intuitive to me that you should be able to make a recovery of what was unjustly gotten from you. So the burden now on the Gemara is to try and explain the reasoning of Rabbi Yochanan. Because Rabbi Yochanan says, now even Torah interest, you cannot recover. You cannot recover it in court. Okay, so Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak says, "My Tama the Rabbi Yochanan." What is Rabbi Yochanan's reasoning? The Amar Kra. He then quotes a scriptural verse, and this is a prophetic verse from the book of Ezekiel. B'neshech natan v'tarbit lakach v'chai lo yichye et kol ha'tarvota ela asa. He who gave on interest and took increase, shall he live? He shall not live. He has done all these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him. Well, that's Ezekiel making a rather strong statement. But who is going to take his life? Not a human court, because we know the human courts. The only reason a human court can take a life is already very explicit in the Torah. And here, the fact that Rabbi Yitzchak has had to go all the way around the corner to the prophets means that this cannot be a human court. Rather, what is being referred to here is the divine court. So in other words, God will punish you. Well, if God will punish you, the implication of that is a human court will not punish you. Okay? So here Rabbi Yitzchak makes reference now to explain Rabbi Yochanan's position, which is that you cannot recover through courts interest that is unjustly gotten. Simply this verse in Ezekiel, which refers to divine punishment, if there is divine punishment for it, then there must not have been a human punishment for it. Okay? Had there been human punishment, by the way, that would have assuaged the divine anger, and there would have been no divine punishment. Right? If a human being pays the price, whatever that price is, then that's considered to certainly not require some divine intercession. So the fact that there is such intercession is a textual proof, at least, from Ezekiel, of Rabbi Yochanan's position. Okay? L'mita nitan v'lo l'ishava. This person who charges interest, l'mita nitan, that person is handed over for death to the divine court. L'ishavon lo, but not to pay back. The person doesn't have to pay back. Okay? At least as far as the court goes. Rav Ada bar Ahava Amar. There is room to speculate on Rabbi Yochanan's reasoning, and we'll have another possibility in the name of another Rabbi, Rav Ada bar Ahava. Amakra, he quotes a different verse. Al tikach me'ito neshech v'tarbit. Now this is in a way possibly a stronger verse, because it's a Torah verse. It's a verse in the book of Leviticus. Al tikach me'ito, you shall not take from him neshech v'tarbit. This is one of the verses that we've been living with now for the past several weeks. V'yareta melokecha. you shall fear your God. L'moranitan v'lo le'ishavonitan. Okay? The end of that verse says, V'yaretam elokecha, you shall fear your God. That is to say, the ultimate responsible partner here is you vis-a-vis God, not vis-a-vis the human court. Not vis-a-vis the human court. Okay? Rava Amar, yet another possible citation reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan's position. Migufe dekra shmielei. Rabbi Yochanan inferred his ruling from the very wording of the verse itself. Mot yumat damav bo yichye. That's the verse in Ezekiel. Mot yumat. Yehiyah, thank you very much. You're correct. Yehiyah. Mot yumat damav bo yehiyah. He shall surely die. His blood shall be upon him. Namely, the victim's blood. That's in the English translation. That's well inserted there. Hukshu malvei ribit l'shofchei damim. Those that lend on interest are compared to those who shed blood. Ma shofchei damim lo nitnu lehishavon. Just when somebody spills blood, there's no way of returning the blood. Right? There's no way out of a situation like that. Af malvei ribit lo nitnu lehishavon. Similarly, a person who loans on interest, there's no way to get out of that. Yes.
It seems to me that you could make the same argument that you can't get restitution from a court. If you violate any Torah, okay. Same reasoning could be, that was applied here, could be applied to any of the Torah. And yet we know, okay, that there are violations of Torah where there is restitution in court.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Correct. So your reasoning is correct. We would have to then show why those particular issues are different from this issue. It's not just a matter of faith. There's got to be a logical reason. And I just remind you that much of the Torah, in fact, is involved in the very specific statement of punishments. We just had a fantastic example of that 2 weeks ago in the Torah reading. In the Parsha of Acharei Mot and Kedoshim, the end of chapter 18 of Leviticus, or not the end, the whole chapter 18 of Leviticus, are the laws of Arayot, the prohibited sexual relations. One thing after another, one thing after another. At the end of Parshat Kedoshim, you get to Leviticus 22. There you have a complete repetition of the same thing. However, in the Leviticus 22, when all those things are mentioned, they're mentioned together with the punishments that are the result of the actions. So, in rabbinic literature, the second one is called onshin, the punishments. The first one is called just the prohibitions. So, indeed, in the articulation of the law, you have to keep that in mind. I think your observation is correct. Any other comments? Okay? Now we move to support for Rabbi Elazar's position that prearranged interest is recoverable in court. Amar Rabbi Nachman bar Yitzchak, my Talmud de Rabbi Elazar. What is the reasoning of Rabbi Elazar? Lachai achicha imach. Your brother shall live with you. Remember that was one of our verses in our list of verses. Open up here, here's the verses. That's Leviticus 25:35. Echi amucha chicha umata yado imach. When your brother is put in straits, and he sticks out his hand to you, dechazakta bo, ger v'toshav v'chai imach. And in effect, and you shall, implied there, is not grab onto him, or treat him as if he's a stranger, rather v'chai imach, he shall live with you. So the force of the end of that verse is v'chai imach. Now if you look down number one here, it's a worthwhile explanation because it will help us to keep this in mind, Rabbi Elazar's reasoning. So that your brother may live with you. Rabbi Elazar therefore understands the commandment to ensure the borrower's economic survival by refunding to him any interest taken. Okay? So there the key thing is the chayimach, that person will be able to live with you. It's economic survival. I think it's actually more than that. That he'll be able to live with you, namely, that you'll get along with each other. Right? You've treated him unjustly. You can't treat him like as if he were a stranger. Rather, you have to treat him the right way, v'chaimach, so that he can live with you, that you guys can get along with each other. Implying, therefore, that the only way that'll happen is if you get your money back. Okay? That's the supposed... I don't... And it seems to me it's not a forceful argument, because it's taking a lot for granted. But that's the argument is stated.
So if my brother's economic position is very unbalanced and I want to help him, should I give him money to start his business and run his family on the loan that I give him? Or should I tell him I will take care of all your food needs and you go and find a job or do whatever you want to do? What is the chayach chaimach? What it means? Help him on the daily issues or help him...
That's Maimonides' list of the priorities of charity. Best charity is to give a person a chance to make his own living. That's the highest level of charity, is to give a person a chance to make his own living. If you can employ a person, if you can give them the startup capital, whatever it is, to allow a person to take care of himself is the best. If you can't do that, there are other secondary levels, and there are 10 levels of charity. But the first one is the first one that you mentioned. That's the desirable one. It's his distillation. Nobody said it the way he did. It's his distillation of a lot of what's in here. He was the first one to distill it, though, in that form.
I still don't understand how they take the chayimecha, meaning that that could be recoverable in court. It could be just as easily implied that you should allow him to live with you, but if it's not,
okay,
God will deal with it.
Read the rest of number one. Go down here, number one. Accordingly, the flow of the verse is as follows. You shall not take interest, but in case you have done so, make sure that your brother continues to live with you by returning the interest to him. Since the lender is required by law to refund interest, since the lender is required to refund interest, the court will enforce its recovery. Hence, Rabbi Elazar's ruling that prearranged interest is recoverable through the judges. Again, I don't think that's a good... It's not a forceful argument. It doesn't really say that. You have to sort of pull it out of it. It's not at all obvious to me. Okay?
I just noticed the nuance, and I don't know if it says it's been meaningful at all, but it's kind of a nuance on this page, where it says Ger v'toshav v'chai imach, and then it continues V'yareta me'elohecha v'chei achicha, with a tere, and it's not a typo because it's also in the title. So chei is the noun. I'm saying it's chayim, the life of your brother is with you. I think it's a nuance here.
Yes, sure. Correct. One is the chai imach, and the other one is the chai achicha imach. Very nice. Well written. What? No, in the Torah it can be also he. It can be chaye or can be he. Okay? Now, just to, again, follow the flow of the logic of the argument, the logic of the argument is such that we now have a reason citing v'chai achicha imach, that piece of the verse, to prove the position of Rabbi Elazar. Well, if that's true, then what does Rabbi Yochanan do with that proof? He's got to have something else that he learns from that verse. Here's what he learns. What the Gemara says, V'Rabbi Yochanan, Hai v'chai achicha imach, Maya vidlei. That piece of the verse, how does he interpret it? How does Rabbi Yochanan interpret it? Right? Mi baya lech l'detanya. The phrase is needed for the lesson that was taught in the Baraita, following Baraita. Shnayim shayu malchim baderech. Two people were traveling along the way. And in the hand of one of them was a flask of water. Well, biyadechad actually means in the possession. Because if you remember last time, I dwelled on the issue of possession, and I'll do it again. One of them has in his possession a flask of water. Im shotim shnehem metim. If they drink, both of them will die. So in other words, it's not enough water for them to both get back to the settlement or to an oasis. The im shoteh achad mehem magia leyishuv. But if one of them drinks, that one is enough water to get back to the settlement. Darash ben Petura interprets, Mutav shiyishtu shnehem v'yamutu. It is better that they both drink and that they both die. Va'al yireh achad mehem b'mitato shel chavero. And that one of them not witness the death of his fellow. Namely, the other one is going to die because of the fact that he's going to live. Right? This is a... How do you call it in the hospitals? When you make a decision between life and death? Triage. This is a triage. Okay? But here, the only difference between the two is that one has it in his possession. V'al yireh achad mehem b'mitato shel chavero. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva v'limed. Till Rabbi Akiva came and taught. V'chei achicha imach. Your brother shall live with you. Chayecha kodnim lechayei chaverecha. This means that your own life takes precedence over your fellow's life. Chayecha imach. Your brother shall live with you. You have to be living for your brother to be able to live with you. So, in other words, your life comes first when there is a decision that has to be made. It's a very interesting idea. It's not a simple idea by any means. Just to again repeat a little bit of what I said last class, what would the Christian say?
Give it to the other guy.
Right? If there is a divine law, the law should say give it to the other guy. And then the Torah's position is an interesting position, which is that they should both die. Now, the reasoning behind that is also not obvious. I mean, it seems to me that there could be two possible reasons. One is sort of stated here, namely you should not witness the death of your fellow. You would feel guilty for it, I suppose. And therefore, it's survivor's guilt. You shall not be in a position of having that survivor's guilt, which is a normal thing that will happen, and maybe that's the reasoning. The other reasoning, which is what I developed in the article, I don't know if any of you spent any time taking a look at that, this was the article from the Mount Sinai Journal of Medicine. forgot the citation. It was 1996. The journal was, I think, either 66 or I think it was 96 or 97. I think it was in the Mount Sinai Journal of Medicine, where the subject being discussed was access to health care. And the logic of the Torah, when applied in terms of health care, is somewhat different. There the logic is that you divide something that really can't solve it for both with the hope that by putting things off, you will find somehow a solution that will benefit both parties. Now, you frequently will invoke that in a variety of different circumstances. You know, here in the two men walking in the desert, there is always the chance that somebody will be coming in the other direction with more water. Right? In the hospital situation that, you know, by the time we in fact run out of our resources, we will have found a way to get new resources. Okay? So Ben Pitura's reasoning is not only, it seems to me, limited to the sort of moral notion or the guilt, survivor's guilt. There's a certain logic to this as well, even though, of course, there's no certainty at all, and perhaps very, very unlikely that both parties will survive. Okay? Now, in the last 100 years, this story has gotten a lot of press. It received a lot of press, first of all, in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Achad HaAm, who was one of the great essayists of Zionism, he was an essayist. And Achad HaAm wrote on a wide variety of subjects. He was a rabbinically competent, sometimes referred to as the rabbi among the Zionists. His essays, by the way, are to this day always worth reading. Essays of Achad HaAm are jewels. Every one is a jewel. They have many, a good number of them, I think, have been translated into English. And I had a chance to read the essays of Achad HaAm. They're wonderful. Achad HaAm argues that Rabbi Akiva's position is Jewish morality, and that is to be contrasted with Christian morality. That it is a virtue of Jewish morality to believe in the capacity of the individual and in the importance of an individual. And he contrasted that with Christianity, which really deprived the individual, in his view, of his own significance. You know that we use downstairs the Hertz Bible. We use the Hertz Pentateuch. And if any of you ever... An interesting thing to do, I don't know how much time you spend looking at Hertz's commentary. But Hertz's commentary is really, it's a fascinating commentary. And it is really a product of the first part of the 20th century. It's kind of amazing that it can still be read. But he had good facility, both as a commentator and with language. And it's well written. It's an extremely well-written commentary, even though it's dated. When we bought those books after we founded our Zarua, we really had a lot of problems deciding which biblical book to use, which Pentateuch to use. In those days, there were far more limited options. 21 years ago, we were very limited in our options. There was Hertz. There was another one that had just come out, an Orthodox one, and there was UAHC, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. There was no Stone Chumash, there was no Eitz Chaim, those didn't exist. And we decided ultimately to go with Hertz. And I must say that Hertz stands the test of time amazingly well. It is dated, no doubt about that, but it's still quite good. And one of the nice things about reading Hertz is, again, if you ever get bored during services, go to the back. You can do it very easily. You would never get bored here, but if it's something happens, you know, it's just it's your life. Even this week, for example, Mahabakukotai, we have a double part parsha, which brings you to the end of Leviticus. At the end of each of the books, he has essays. His essays are fascinating because he's usually decrying one of his enemies. He is a polemical essayist, and he's always attacking somebody. So either he's attacking biblical criticism of the end of the 19th century, which is his memoir in most cases, or somebody else. The other one is Christianity.
Yeah.
It's either Christianity or biblical criticism, and they're sort of the same thing. Do you know that Hertz got his rabbinical, he was the chief rabbi of the British Empire. You know where he got his rabbinical smicha?
In Hungary.
No.
In Hungary.
Not as far as I know.
He got it
in the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. He was in the seminary when Solomon Schechter was the president of the Jewish Theological Seminary. So when I was a student, I lived, one or 2 years in what was then the seminary dormitory, and I got a tremendous charge always going out, and they had all the class pictures. I came into the seminary in 1966, so they had about 60 years of class pictures. That's where they decorated the halls. And in one of those pictures was Dr. J.H. Hertz with his class, 1904 or 3 or 2, something like that. And so we were always very proud of students. So Hertz was a seminary grad. You know. And he was the chief rabbi and was the chief Orthodox rabbi of the British Empire. So
I lived next door to him, his house in England.
Did you?
Just about next door, and four houses down is Jonathan Sachs's house.
So you lived in a good Jewish neighborhood.
Yeah, well, it was. In fact, one night I was taking a walk after dinner, and two men came up and said, "Could you tell me where the chief rabbi's house is?" And I said, "Yes, it's just on the next block. Why don't you walk with me? He'll point it out to you." And as we were walking, they said, "Are you a congregant?" And I said, "No, it's in the York conservative Jew." And one of the men sighed and said, "That's what I want to come back in the next world."
That's the truth. Really?
Yep. True story.
Okay. Well, now that you mention the neighborhood,
it's called Hamilton Terrace.
I see. I don't know anything about any of that. The comments that I'm sharing with you are from an essay which was written by the late Rabbi Louis Jacobs.
I went to his synagogue.
Oh, here we go. Louis Jacobs was a wonderful, wonderful scholar, and this was published in a volume on contemporary Jewish ethics, edited by Professor Menachem Kellner. And Jacobs had published this before, but it was reprinted in Kellner's volume. And here he writes, "Dr. J.H. Hertz follows the Chada'am. Writing in his commentary to the Pentateuch on the Golden Rule in Judaism, he remarks, Rabbi Akiva could not agree that two should perish where death demands but one as its toll. And indeed, if the Torah had meant that a man must love his neighbor to the extent of sacrificing his life for him in all circumstances, it would have said, thou shalt love thy neighbor more than thyself." Hertz is really good. There's this wonderful facility with language to make an argument. He's a polemical writer. So Hertz took the same point of view as Chada'am, and you will frequently see that, and that's part of his anti-Christian polemic, which you find in the Hertz commentary. Realize that as a rabbi in England in the beginning of the 20th century, he was trying to legitimize Judaism as a reasonable religion, because Judaism was, until late in the 20th century, a despised religion. I think in Europe it's going back to being that again, unfortunately, in the 21st century. It was a long time to create the intellectual framework for arguments to justify the reasonableness of Judaism. Interestingly enough, Louis Jacobs takes the opposite point of view. And he argues against both Chada'am and Rabbi Hertz. And he says that while it is true, while it may be true that a person should keep the water for himself, first of all, who is to say that that's really the right thing to do in the circumstance? We may say that you are allowed to do that, and we cannot hold it against you if you do it. But that's not the same thing as saying that it's a noble act. He argues that religion really requires from people, or tries to have people aspire to, more noble types of behavior than simply self-preservation. And that in Judaism, as well as in other religions, but certainly in Judaism, it is considered a saintly act to be able to give up one's own interests, even one's own life, for the other. That's Louis Jacobs. And he argues even halachically, he argues that people in general assume that because Rabbi Akiva and Ben Batura are the two protagonists, that since the law normally will go according to Rabbi Akiva, that is the case. And therefore the law goes according to Rabbi Akiva. But he points out, and I want to point out to you, look in the text, in the actual Talmud text, to where this appears. It's right across. You can see the gray line in the margin. And it's, let me see. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down. Ad shabar Rabbi Akiva v'limed chay achicha imach chayecha kodmin v'chayecha v'cha. You see that? From time to time, when we looked at the original Talmud text in the center of the page, I've noted to you that there are ways that you can reference the text and see what is law. Excuse me. You can see what is law. You will frequently have a superscript, and a superscript that will refer to the Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. Look in the very top left-hand corner of the Talmud page. See, it says Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. Does everybody see that? Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah. Underneath that are block Hebrew letters. First is a Tetvav, then it's Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Just notice the form of those letters. They're block characters, as opposed to Rashi script or italicized script. They have no parentheses after them. They're simply block, heavy, how would you say it? Bold. They're bold block Hebrew characters. Now, when you have the law in the Talmudic text, in particular, if you have two people arguing with one another, and one of them is in fact accepted by Maimonides, by the Shulchan Aruch, as being the law, the way you can often be sensitive to that is to see that block letter in the text itself as a superscript. Let's see if we can find one. Where are these first ones? I might parrot Dalad Nehuchot Malveh. I see the pet. Oh, here's an Aleph. Okay.
The top right.
No, not the top right. See, that one has a parenthesis after it. That's not it.
Okay, so
that's not it. So go down to what I just told you, the Rabbi Akiva line. Go down two lines below that. Hiniach, the word hiniach, has above it, the hay of hiniach has above it a heavy superscript block aleph. Okay? Therefore, you know that what follows is the law. That's what follows is the law. Now, the reason that I'm showing you that is, up above where it said Rabbi Akiva, if that were the law, you would expect a superscript above Rabbi Akiva. And in fact, one of the things that you learn is that in both those points of view, neither was ever codified as law. Neither was ever codified as law. And in fact, none becomes the law. And these are simply two points of view, both of which are cited from time to time in different circumstances.
There needs to be a resolution.
You would like there to be. This is one of these tough questions. It's a tough question, and the bottom line is that the law was never decided. That is one of the arguments made by Louis Jacob. He doesn't show you what I just showed you, but he just says that the law, there's no place where you can cite that this was accepted by the later commentators as law.
The only problem I have with Louis Jacob's argument is I think there's a natural, we have a natural tendency to interpret it. It's that the natural thing to do is to sustain your own life, and we think of it as being selfish. But I think without Rabbi Akiva, in effect, telling us do it this way, we forget that very often the natural tendency would be specifically to have both of you perish. If you don't have somebody...
You're absolutely right. Ben Pitori's argument is a very good argument. Okay, but Rabbi Akiva's argument is maybe a much better argument. That's really a crucial argument. There's no doubt about it.
I want to bring the issue of the Kiton of mind to practicality in two levels. One, emergency and non-emergency, planned how to use the water, or emergency when you really need to use the water and now. And two, the Israeli army in the early days, we used to have mishmat mind. Means if we went to the desert from exercise or to any activities, we really consume as less possible water. And nowadays they don't have it anymore.
They don't have it?
No,
really?
Too many people dehydrated, they decided to forget about it then. Nowadays the Israeli army don't have mishmat mind. But in my time, and maybe a few years after me, we used to have mishmat mind.
Because I remember reading after the Second Lebanon War, which was not such a good experience for the Israeli army.
Yeah, because they went unprepared.
They were unprepared.
That was a different story.
Right, they didn't have enough water, some of the soldiers said.
The water didn't have uniforms.
Correct.
But that's a job.
Right.
You know, we don't consider it as a plan.
Right.
So how we deal with emergency in the story of the water... Mm-hmm. And how you deal in a planned situation that you...
Well, in a planned situation, you should plan to take water.
You
should definitely plan.
You took, and the road is too long.
Well, certainly, if your fellow has water and you have water and you can share water in order to enable you both to live, that would be the clear alternative that you should share with each other if there is enough for two. Okay? So... It seems
so in a planned situation, it shouldn't happen. That's what...
Ideally, correct.
So that...
Right, this is the situation which is not planned.
Okay,
where, in fact, you find yourself in this situation. Now, remember, I raised with you last time the importance of possession, the issue of possession, that many of the commentators really see that as the key issue as far as the water goes. It is simply because the water is in the possession of one that person ends up having certain rights of access to it. Because we could think of a slightly different situation, which is where there is common water. Let's say in the army situation. Right? In the army situation, it could be that there is simply common water for everybody. In the medical ethics situation, we have a limited resource. I argue in the article that to some extent resources, should be conceived of as commonly held resources. For example, tax monies, monies that are owned by the state. Those in theory are common resources. Neither you nor I has any possession of what we give to the state once we have paid our taxes. So that an argument could be made then that what is owned in common should be divided in common, if indeed there are common needs. So that's a dangerous slope to go down. I realize there's the problems with that, because the reality is that when you have scarce resources, the real issues become political. It becomes deciding what the priorities are in a population for the distribution of those commonly held resources. And that is the common problem of government. Right? The government raises a certain amount of money, it's got to decide what it will do with those resources. It's got a lot of people pulling them in different directions.
I guess the question I have is that why do you think that the alternatives of you either give it to the other guy or flip a coin, okay, you know, were never raised in the context of this choice? Because the choice was either two guys die or the other guy, or, you know, the owner gets it. I mean, it would seem to me that there's a certain logical argument, but we're saying, why don't you flip a coin? At least somebody lives. Okay. I can see why you could say, you know, that both guys drink it and everybody dies. Mm-hmm. It's not a good choice.
Okay, well, let me answer one at a time. First of all, what's wrong with the flip a coin possibility? The problem with that is that one person owns the water. And the law presupposes that ownership gives you certain rights. As we would assume, let's say, in our modern context, if you have the money to get a certain type of medical treatment, you have the right to that. If you're going to pay for it, you can have anything you want to pay for. And the other guy, in fact, has no rights to what you have. Right? He doesn't really have rights to you, unless we would figure out a government that would take your money. You know, government can do that, and that's the prerogative of government to make those decisions. Right? So the possession is the key issue there. Possession is the key issue. And that is something which is quite true in the Bible, and it's true in classical Judaism here in the rabbinic period, that possession is considered to be a significant factor, that human beings have the right to possess. Your rights of possession have a certain sanctity to them, and the law respects what you own.
Then why did the Christians go the other way?
I'm not sure that... Let's take Louis Jacob's point of view. Louis Jacob says Judaism also believes that certain types of behavior are saintly behavior. What's the difference between that and Christianity? The difference between that and Christianity, I think Jacobs would say, is that is for the extraordinary individual. There are people who are capable of doing that. But we cannot force such a level of behavior on the average man. We have to respect who the average person is and also encourage people who can do what's called lifnim mishurat adin, beyond the letter of the law. The law should function for most people most of the time. Exceptions to the law, extraordinary behavior may be possible, but the law cannot enforce that. Right? That's the issue you have also in Good Samaritan law. It's a very interesting issue. If you see somebody drowning, do we say that you have to jump in and help them? Right? If you see somebody in trouble, do you have to give them tzedakah? You don't have to do any of those things. There's nothing wrong with doing it, and in fact, we'd like the law of the state to protect you in case, let's say, you fail. God forbid somebody in the family of the drowning person said, he caused it. Right? He caused it. It was his lack of knowledge, or he flubbed it. And he was the cause of the death. In a way, we want laws to protect the Good Samaritan. But essentially, we cannot require people to be Good Samaritans. So those are the two answers. Okay?
Where do we find the answer to the question, how did you achieve possession?
Well, it doesn't matter. We're assuming here that the possession is a rightful possession. Right? Because simply that's not raised. There is no question raised about that. The only possession that, in fact, is not a rightful possession, which is a problem for us here, is the possession of interest. Because remember, the man who has charged interest possesses the interest. And that's not a rightful possession. So that's a more problematic one. And that's why we're dealing with that, to know whether we have the right of the court to go ahead and take it out of his hand.
With Christianity, though, the entire focus has shifted away from this world toward a different value system, and by giving up your life, you're emulating God's sacrifice for mankind.
That's a good point. Correct. That's also quite relevant. It's all part of the peace. In Christianity, we know that the life in the next world is more central than it is in Judaism. It is not absent in Judaism, but it's yet more central in Christianity, and it all works together. You can see how it can work together here, that in fact, the rewards that you receive in this world pale next to the rewards you receive in the next world. And so therefore, your concerns for your welfare in this world really should not take precedence when compared to the next world. So then you're going to
I love the story. Also, I like your message, but I like that it's unresolved.
Yes.
Why is because I think it would be wrong to flip a coin.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone owns something, so let's say you allow for ownership, that allows for the owner to do good with what he or she owns. So let's say, I can imagine some circumstances where two people would be in the desert walking with a flask, and it would be in their communal interest for one of them to walk. I mean, the easiest example for me to give is in my own. Let's say I were with my son, age 20.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a no-brainer. I would absolutely 100% want him to have the water and
mm-hmm.
go, because he would make it, and it would be such a clear and easy decision. So, and there are many examples
right.
of that. So that one's just very obvious to me. So I think this allows for discussion between the two parties.
Mm-hmm.
You take it because that you need to get a message to the town, or because you are, save a life, whatever.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's exactly right. And it's partly the lack of resolution that allows you to do that.
So in your argument about how you create a law that we can expect a fair number of people to adhere to or meet, but we don't expect all, what does that imply then in setting up an army obligation to fight, to take care of one another? Same thing for police force.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You
correct.
Decide those are not exceptional issues.
Correct.
Those are everyday.
Correct.
Issues.
You're right.
We, of course, have seen it just recently for ourselves and acting out.
Louis Jacobs mentions that, and he argues that in the Bible, taking up arms for whatever the reason is, if it be a justified reason for taking up arms, in fact, we do send people to their deaths.
But we expect them also to do more.
Exactly.
We do expect them to do
correct. Correct. What do you mean we expect them to do more?
Oh, I'm sorry. Your argument before about behavior and
mm-hmm.
how we expect people to take, we can't create a law where everyone is obligated
right.
to reach out to help the drowning person
mm-hmm.
in your illustration.
Right.
But yet, it seems to me, in an army or in a police force, you do need to have some element of the obligation
mm-hmm.
to go more.
Mm-hmm. Are we true?
You're right. And we have seen it many times, even
that's
in our
correct.
Own lives.
Correct.
Experiences.
Correct.
So how does the rabbis articulate that part of it?
that would be, I think that, well, from Jacob's perspective, for sure, that is a noble thing to do. It is a noble thing to do, and indeed we do from time to time ask or reward people for their nobility. We reward them for the, and we may require them, but that requirement is done in order, it's got to be a very basic reason for that requirement, and has to be, in most cases, to protect somebody else. Because there what we are doing is saying that if somebody comes and attacks you, and again, it's similar here, you are required to defend yourself. We believe in the requirement of self-defense, because that too is not obvious. It's not obvious that you should defend yourself. It may be, I can imagine a line of reasoning, which is that you should not defend yourself. That it's a higher calling to give your life, because the one who is taking your life really is doing the worst act. You have a higher act just to not defend yourself, because by defending yourself, you're going to kill somebody. Now, our perspective is that you are required to defend yourself. And frankly, these attach to one another. The belief in the integrity of the individual, even to the extent that the individual is required to maintain a self-defense, is a very Jewish idea. It shouldn't be taken for granted.
A couple of thoughts. One is about the Nazarite and the ambivalence about taking on extra vows and the cautions. So there's the possibility of doing it, but it's certainly not expected, and it's also clear that...
That's a nice analogy, yes, you're right.
That you do that with a lot of controls and don't allow young children to do that without their parental agreement, and there's a lot of structure around the Nazarite, which I think reflects very much what's being said. But to me, I think there are a couple of elements that sort of fit in here. The first is you're God's creation. You don't really have the right to not respect it. And I think that lies at the heart of a lot of the comments that were just made about defending yourself and the other interactions. I think it's the second level is the definition of the unit. Because, you know, if you think in evolutionary terms, sometimes the unit is the individual, but sometimes the unit really isn't. And especially in a religious context, the unit may not be the individual. In your essay, you went on to the priorities, and it would be interesting to think about those priorities, because if the context is to do mitzvot, then maybe it becomes pretty obvious as to among a unit of two people who were faced with a problem, how you would maximize the mitzvot that are going to still be able to be done. Or if the other issue that I think is very germane is the issue of reproduction. Is there a hierarchy that relates to decision-making with regard to reproduction that might equally be considered a key element in the unit being the Jewish people and their responsibility. We have one very clear precedent in medicine about having to make tough decisions. Most of it's theoretical, but there's one that's very practical, and that's deus organs. And we've evolved a very complex, truly political to some extent, but political to the extent that it's tried to be depoliticized by setting certain criteria for who is next in line for an organ based upon medical criteria that in fact attempt to diffuse the non-medical aspects of it. But obviously there are many value judgments that went into that. But that's the one where you can tell the most about the society's values in terms of dealing with
the priorities. Yeah. Very good.
Do you think maybe the way the
contract is phrased intends for us to say, you don't know what you can do, you don't know what you can't do, you don't know what you need to do until you face that situation. You don't know whether the person who had the flask of water was the owner. Two people set out, and if they had one flask, I'll carry the water, you carry the sleeping bags. We know there are only two people, but we don't know whether one is old and one is young, one became ill on the trip, and one who was not ill had to help the only 3-day trip became a 6-day trip, and they ran out of water. I think, you know, as you said, Rabbi Akiva, we know stories where fathers gave their ration of bread to the children, to their children. Probably would not have given it to someone else's children.
Correct.
So the whole structure suggests, like many issues that have a moral ethical component, which we have in this country and everyone realizes, and a kind of political component. Because people want to say, let's have a law about it. But at the same time, the people who want the law and the people who pass laws probably think to themselves, you know, if I had to deal with the situation myself in my own life, I would have to make that decision for myself, not to have somebody else look out. I like the way it's structured because you read it twice and you say, well, yeah, but what if? My father, it was my son. I don't know. You can't possibly. So that's why there's no
no conclusion.
No
superscript.
What strikes me so interesting here is the analogy is just going to be so inappropriate to begin with, because this is a life and death situation we're talking about. Interest, and the person has to get the interest. But I mean, I think this is probably some significance there, which we've discussed all along about the seriousness with which the rabbi approached this topic in terms of keeping society happy.
I think that let's underline that for a moment. I think that, you know, that's part of the charm of the story, is that it's so odd. Suddenly we're faced with such a morally compelling set of circumstances when we've been dealing with money. You know, and it just, why? But I think your point is well taken. The reality is, that's the whole point of the discussion about money. The whole point of the discussion about money is to set up a moral context. And we're really not even sure, as we are discussing now, whether this is a legal issue or a moral issue. Because we're not sure whether you can get your money back in court. That's really the bottom line here. So here you are with another moral, just sort of a moral exclamation point, which is just so obvious once you read the story. So what is that?
I wonder if this principle is applicable to other situations. For example, I heard a story where a manager was told, okay, well, you know, business is tough, we have to make some cuts. Here's your choice. You can either fire 3 people or resign.
First of all, say, Uncle Omer. Okay, we're getting there. Yesterday we counted the 36th day of the Omer. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher kiddeshanu b'mitzvot v'tzivanu al sfirat haOmer. Hayom shiva u'shloshim yom. שהם 5 שבועות ושני ימים לעומר. This now makes 37 days, which makes 5 weeks and 2 days of the Omer. הרחמנו יחזיר לנו עבודת בית המקדש במקומה, במהרה בימינו אמן סלע. Okay. sorry, Mike.
Well, I was just wondering if this principle, okay, is applicable to other situations in life or death. The example I gave, the manager was in possession of the power, okay, to do it, okay, and he could either let three people go or resign himself. That was his call. If he followed the principle here, okay, he would have let the other managers go, and he would have kept his job. So I wonder if it's applicable.
I think the principle is, as a moral issue, it would seem to me it is applicable. It's not as forceful a moral issue as where you're dealing with life and death. I'll tell you very honestly, I had somebody come to see me some while ago complaining about the reality of law firms today. Lawyers, forgive me. I'm just telling you what somebody else came to complain about. This was somebody who was an associate in a law firm, and the associates were being fired right and left. Without the partners giving up much of what they were earning. So that the way the partners dealt with this was not, you know, there was a lack of business in the last year and a half. The partners could either have taken home less or fired the associates. For them, it was an easy call. They fired the associates. And they just didn't want to take home less money. Or, I don't mean they fired all the associates. They fired an awful lot of them. You know, plenty of them were let go. At that time, one of our congregants then spoke up and just made the point that in his firm they had decided not to do that. That was an issue being discussed by the partners of the firm, whether once the pie was a smaller pie, it was important for the partners to share more equally with the associates. But that's the discussion. That's exactly what you're talking about here. So it seems to me, as a moral issue, it would be also healthy if that would be a part of the discussion. Because there are times that the resources are scarce. You know, we're still living right in the middle of one right now. Henry was next. Henry.
I don't know if it's in order. I mean, I'm really interested in what the priorities would be for the organ donor thing. I mean, for example, you'd think maybe the first one is who's got the greater chance of survival, which is kind of like who's the closest, who's got the most chance of getting to the next town with a bottle of water. Maybe a priority is the relationship of the donor somehow, in case there's somebody's family or whatever who needs the organ. That's is there a first come, first served?
Barry, you want to tell us what it is?
Well, it's complicated. You have to be sick, so you don't give it to well people when there were sick people who need it, or they're less likely to make it.
Right.
On the other hand, if they're too sick, then they're not likely to benefit from
right.
it. So there is this really complicated series of criteria that have been developed to try to make sure that it gets to the most needy person who's most likely to benefit.
Is there a written internet kind of thing?
Oh, sure. No. Yeah, this is the organ donor system. It periodically reviews the criteria and updates them based upon new medical facts and new issues. But there, the priority really is focused primarily on medical need, not on many of the other considerations.
How about age? Is that relevant, Barry?
I forget exactly how that's handled. I just don't remember what the criteria are.
There's an age. I'm aware of somebody that they were at 60, and that they were cut off early. So it depends. There is a whole priority, but age was one of the considerations.
That's not based on worthiness. That's based on probably the medical likelihood of benefit.
Correct.
Right.
Right. Different.
But
that's very different.
They're very different issues. Right. So, but obviously, this, if you really want to see where society makes decisions and priorities, this is one of the model systems, because there is no choice. They must make a decision on who's next on the list to get the organ. The life or death thing, though, just Jack Benny, remember?
Yes. Remind him.
Jack Benny.
I'm thinking.
Yes. It was only at the time of the war when my father, he carried to his death, and he really couldn't, he didn't talk about it, but after his parents were taken away, him and his sister started to run away together, and the age difference wasn't balanced enough. So at a certain point, they had to separate. He survived, and she died, and it was an agreement between them, and they made a decision to separate. And it was on his mind until
his last day.
And it's exactly the situation. And he couldn't, we didn't talk about it, but we knew the issue. And that was a known decision between the strong and the weak, the able and maybe the not able. And nobody knew the chances.
Correct. I guess he could have put his sister on his back.
He put him in cold, where he said,
Correct. He could have put his sister on his back and they would have both died. It's a similar kind of thing.
Certain ages could be that one is the wife or the daughter, and there was a way to sneak through the system. But they had made this decision, and that's what happened.
Okay. Let's go on. Let's use the last several minutes that we have to go on with this a little bit further. Meteve. Now, we have a Breita brought as an argument against Rabbi Yochanan's view that interest is not recoverable. Okay? That's what Rabbi Yochanan says. You can't recover it in court. Hiniach lehem abihem ma'ot shel ribit. If a father dies and leaves his children money that was taken as interest, okay? His father made money. Money is in his estate now. And it's going to the children. Af al pi shiodim shehem shall ribit, even though they know it was taken in interest, einan chayavim lahachsiran. They are not required to return it. That's a beretta. They're not required to return it. The Gemara then says, ha avien chayav lahachsir. Because the beretta says that they're not required to return it. It's as if they're saying, they're underlining the word they, namely the children, the inheritors of the estate. But that is to say that the father would have been required to return it. Okay? Well, that logic is not necessarily the only way to understand this baraita. As the Gemara says, bidinhu. The fact is, the Abu Honami lo mechayev lahachsir. The fact is that the father, it's logical that the father was also not required to return it. Father's not required to return it either. Both of them are not required. The father as well as the estate. However, since the Tana wished to teach in the latter part of the Beraita a case that relates specifically to the children, namely, hiniach lehem avihem, if their father left them, para, vitalit, the whole davar hamisuyam, a cow, or a cloak, or any distinct object that he had taken as interest, chayavim lahachzir mipnei kavod avihem, they are required to return that because of the honor of their father. Taninami Resha Beditu. Therefore the Tana taught the first part of the Baraita in reference to the children. So what's going on here? There is something taken as interest. There are two possibilities for interest. Either an object of some kind or money. Now, as far as the possession of the children who are inheriting the estate goes, there are certain things, even after death, we are required to honor our parents. We're required to avoid situations that might be embarrassing to our parents. And so what this Baraita is saying is, in the case of somebody who has taken interest, and that interest is an object, even though the law is that you don't have to return it, namely, the court cannot be used to require you to return it, still, when it gets to the next generation, the court now says that you must return it. Why? Because objects stand out. People come and they know that the parent has collected improper interest, and eventually it just, it's in your face.
It's removing stain.
It's correct. And it's a stain that's right there. As far as money goes, nobody knows about it. It simply doesn't reflect on the parent. Okay? So, at least it's possible then that the parent is not embarrassed, because we have to be concerned about how we continue to relate to our parents. Right, let me go a little bit further. Now, the Gemara doesn't like what we've just read. Do you mean to see these children are really obligated to return the interest because of their father's honor? Krikan. Remember the verse. And recall the verse that says, V'nasi b'amcha lo ta'or. A leader among your people, you shall not curse. Bo'oseh ma'aseh amcha. That is to say, a person who does the deeds of the people. In other words, the Torah says, you shall not curse your leader. What if your leader should be cursed? Are we to say that we simply respect authority? A person is evil and uses his leadership for evil. You can't curse that person? Of course you can curse that person. Okay? In fact, a person foregoes his dignity sometimes on the basis of his deeds. And so if the father was a crook, hasn't he foregone the honor that is due to him? The guy has done all kinds of terrible things. You mean to see these children have to protect him? From people who are going to say, you know, they're going to look at the object and say, your father took interest. Why? He was not supposed to do that in the first place. Just as you're allowed to curse somebody who is an evil leader. We're not saying you curse your father, but you don't have to protect him. Okay? Now, that's a very interesting issue. A very interesting issue. Question is, does a parent who is a wicked person forgo the rights to be protected? And the law is hard to come by here. Let me read to you what the Shulchan Aruch says. Actually, the Shulchan Aruch says two things. Mamzer chayav b'chvod aviv uv'moro. A mamzer, even though he's a mamzer, the definition of a mamzer is somebody who is illegitimate according to the law. Namely, the father has had relations with a woman that the Torah says you cannot have relations to. A mamzer doesn't mean somebody born out of wedlock. Because you can have relations with an unmarried woman, and that's not forbidden by the law of the Torah. You're not supposed to do it, but it's not forbidden. This is a case, let's say, of an adulterous affair, where there is adultery. Product of that is a mamzer. So the question is, then has a relation with an adulterous woman, does the child have to honor his parents? Right? The child then has to be born. Once he is born, does he have the same obligations as everybody else? The answer is, yes, he does. Doesn't matter what gave birth, you know, what was the source of it all, you are required. Afilu haya aviv. Now this is Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in the Shulchan Aruch. Afilu haya aviv rasha uval averot. Even if his father was wicked and possessed many sins, nechabdo umitjarei mimenu. A person still has to honor him and fear him. Then the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserlis, has the Ashkenazi commentary on this. So this is the Sfardi law so far. Ashkenazi commentary is this. V'yesh omrim, there are those who say, the eno michuyav lechabed aviv rasha. A son is not required to honor a wicked father. Ela im kein asa tshuva, unless the father has done tshuva. If a person does tshuva, then the situation is different. Okay? So, it's an interesting little piece of law. Maimonides here is the source that Rabbi Yosef Karo uses. I read you Maimonides. Amamzer chayav b'chvod aviv umara'o. That's what I read you at first. A mamzer is required to honor his father and to fear him. Af al pi shehu patur al makato v'kilulato adchi. Even though if the child were to strike the father, that child is not subject to the death penalty the way a normal child would be. Because we understand that children who are born... Such children can have issues, we would say. They can have issues. And so we're sympathetic with some of the issues that that child might have. Afilu haya aviv rasha ubal averot nechabdo umitjare mimenu. Even if his father was wicked and transgressed many sins, he is required to honor and to fear him. So the Rama really disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch and with Maimonides.
What is their understanding of what it means for the man to be
Rasha? Yeah, well, that's not clear. And that's why the commentators to Maimonides raised that as the issue. The issue is, what are we talking about here? And what are the nature of a person's sins? Because there are certain things that we can understand, particularly if they are vis-a-vis the child. Because the child may be suffering for the deeds of the parent. That's not the same thing as saying the child should not honor the parent if the parent has wronged other people. So there are a variety of possibilities here. Okay? Questions? We'll be continued.
Thank you.